Right now on Current State, why is Richard Spencer bringing his white nationalist views to MSU? And how is one church celebrating diversity in spite of him? We are 8 months from voting for a new governor. Find out how the candidates are trying to shore up their base outside of Lansing. But first, new legislation to protect victims of sexual abuse and misconduct in Michigan.
The work being done here in Michigan shows that we will no longer protect predators and their enablers as opposed to the victims.
Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. This week, Michigan lawmakers rolled out new legislation aimed at curbing sexual misconduct. They were joined by survivors of former physician Larry Nassar, who abused more than 200 girls and women at Michigan State University, USA Gymnastics, and other programs when he was supposed to be treating them. Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth was at the rollout and joins me now. Welcome, Shayna.
Hello.
We understand one bill would extend the statute of limitations for criminal and civil cases. In addition to being a reporter, you're a former prosecutor. Why is this important?
One of the things that several of these survivors mentioned and the lawmakers mentioned is that especially in sexual assault cases, especially in sexual assault cases of children, it takes them a long time to come forward, to reckon with what happened, to understand what happened. So a lot of people, they're not going to, you know, be ready to say I was sexually assaulted, you know, maybe for decades. And what this would do is this would give them that time that is in some cases normal with sexual assault cases to come forward and still have a claim and still be able to pursue justice.
Another bill would make youth sports coaches and athletic trainers mandatory reporters of child abuse. So is this a direct response to allegations MSU did not take complaints about Nassar seriously?
I think so. They want to make, like you said, they want to make more people mandatory reporters. But another part of it that also is kind of in direct response to the MSU officials is that they want to also increase penalties. They want to, if you are a paid employee, they want to make it a felony if you're supposed to report and you don't. And they believe that this will make sure that if somebody is a mandatory reporter and that they will indeed come forward. Because I think what they're thinking is that some of these people, because there wasn't a big enough penalty or they weren't required to report, that's why they didn't. They didn't tell anybody. And that's what allowed for Nassar to keep going and be as prolific as he was.
We know MSU student Lindsay Lemke was one of the first survivors to come forward, and she was at that press conference. Let's listen to what she had to say.
I did not feel believed. I did not feel trusted. I did not feel safe. I thought that I was going to get in trouble. I was terrified that my scholarship that I worked so hard for was going to be taken away. I was attempted to be silenced, the exact same way so many women were silenced at Michigan State for decades. This legislation will change that. Brave survivors who come forward will not be dismissed.
We're back now talking with Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth. Do we know of any opposition that's been public?
Yeah, it was interesting. During the committee hearing, we heard from the ACLU of Michigan. They're worried about potential unintended consequences of a couple of these bills, one of which that they're concerned about is this mandatory reporter bill. And they're concerned about these penalties, about extending who is a mandatory reporter, but mostly they're concerned about increasing penalties because what they said is, you know, in some cases, it's better for maybe family members or people who are not law enforcement to handle these types of situations. They're kind of thinking of cases where the individual maybe has some mental problems or things like that. And then the Catholic Conference has said that they are concerned about extending the statute of limitations and the potential consequences of that.
Well, we've been talking about the new sexual misconduct bills rolled out by state lawmakers here in Michigan this week. With Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth, we know you're staying on top of it, and thank you for joining us, Shayna.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. If there's one thing we've heard from survivors of Larry Nassar's sexual abuse cases, MSU students and others, it's not always clear where victims of sexual misconduct can turn for support. Starting Tuesday on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, we will bring you WKAR Connects. We're connecting you with Capital Region resources and services on issues of domestic violence, sexual assault, and much more. WKAR's Katie Cook is our lead reporter on this initiative and joins us in studio. Katie, welcome to Current State.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about one of the community organizations that you're focusing on in your reports.
I would like to highlight the Women's Center of Greater Lansing. I didn't know much about them, so I really enjoyed learning about the services they offer, and they are just very passionate and doing great work for the community. My conversation with the director, Cindy Allwood, was really inspiring, and she explained some of their services and just the approach that they take to being there for women and also men who need them.
We offer for anyone a safe space, a place to go where there may not be anywhere else to go, and you'll have someone here to listen. You'll have someone who's non-judgmental. You'll be believed. We'll trust you, and we'll listen to whatever it is that you need to tell us. And on top of that, we have really good coffee and really good chocolate. So, I mean, it's a very serious topic, I don't mean to make light of it at all with that, but it's amazing to me. And the cats, you know, that's that whole experience where you come in and you're traumatized and terrified and don't know what to do, and the first thing we do is take care of those basic needs. Mm-hmm. Please come sit. Would you like something warm to drink? If the cat feels like you need him, he will come and sit with you. And so we try to break down those barriers that a lot of women already put on themselves to talking about this by just our environment.
It's comfort.
It's comfort, exactly.
So, Katie, what other organizations will we hear about?
Well, I also talked to Eve and Violent Encounters, the Firecracker Foundation, and Small Talk. They all have a little bit of a different focus, but all of them have great services for victims of sexual abuse, domestic violence. Some of them are focused on children. Some have more services for adults, just kind of different variety.
Well, in addition to Katie's report, Morning Edition host Brooke Allen will talk with the Michigan State University students who created teal Facebook frames in support of Larry Nassar's victims. Plus, she'll report on the challenges of addressing sexual abuse in LGBTQ communities. So turning back to Katie, was there anything that surprised you while researching these nonprofits?
You know, one of the things that surprised me was how almost all of these services are free. I guess maybe I should have known that with nonprofits, that tends to be the case. But I was just really amazed at all that they're able to offer and that they're at no cost to the victims, the survivors, anyone who comes and needs the services.
Thank you, Katie. And we look forward to hearing your WKAR Connects stories starting Tuesday on Morning Edition, 5 to 9 a.m. Many eyes will be on Michigan State University on Monday afternoon when white nationalist Richard Spencer will give an invitation-only speech at the MSU Pavilion. Spencer is president of the National Policy Institute, an ultra-conservative group that espouses white supremacy. Spencer was a key figure in the Unite the Right rally last August in Charlottesville, Virginia, an incident which saw violent protests and three fatalities. MSU Police Captain Doug Manette says a team of law enforcement will be in place to keep the peace.
There will be officers inside the building as well as outside the building to ensure that this is safe, just like it is every day on the MSU campus.
WKAR interviewed Richard Spencer in a story that will air on Monday's Morning Edition program. And as digital news director of this station, I want to make it clear that the intent behind our story was not to reshare Spencer's beliefs. Those have already been widely reported. We simply wanted to know why he wanted to come to MSU so badly that he took the university to court. Let's bring in WKAR Scott Pohl, who talked with Spencer. So what did he have to say to you?
Well, I think I might start by bringing up the question that I asked about the scheduling of this event, which has to do with being on the Monday of spring break and the fact that there wouldn't be a lot of students on campus. Most students would be away. Let's listen to just a little bit of that.
I would like to speak in a prime time space. There is certainly enough interest to warrant that. That is, I would like to speak at 7 p.m. in a central location, and certainly when school is in session. However, my team and I decided to compromise and agree to this in order to set an important precedent going forward.
So along with that remark, Richard Spencer said that certainly not all students will be gone. There are many members of the community that he thinks will want to come, and he has no doubt that there will be counter-protesters as well. He says that as long as counter-protesters are peaceful, stand outside with signs, or even come inside to ask questions, he says he'll engage them in dialogue.
What else did you ask Richard Spencer?
Well, we talked about things like the location of this speech. His initial request had been to speak at the Union Building, and the location that they settled on was the auditorium in the MSU Agriculture Pavilion, and that's on the far southern fringe of the campus. And I even mentioned there was a rodeo there the week before. And so we talked about the location and how he felt about that. It was part of the compromise, he says, reached with the university in order to arrive at a place where they could agree to let him speak on campus.
Okay, well, we've been talking with WKAR's Scott Pohl, who is preparing an interview with the white nationalist Richard Spencer that will air Monday morning on Morning Edition. And Scott will be out there to help us cover the story on Monday afternoon at the MSU Pavilion. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Thank you.
For people seeking a different viewpoint from Richard Spencer's, the All Saints Church in East Lansing will have an event at the same time of Spencer's speech. And joining me now is Pastor Kit Carlson. Welcome.
Hi. So we decided to plan this counter event. It's not a counter protest. It's really a counter party. And we're calling it the Celebrate Diversity Festival. And we have inside and outside activities. And it's just been amazing how all kinds of groups have come together to support this. And I can't say enough about the wonderful student groups at MSU, Council Graduate Students, ASMSU, Residence Hall Association, Interfraternity, Panhellenic, the MSU College Democrats, the MSU College Republicans, the Student Libertarians have all joined to support and sponsor this event. It's been just incredible.
Pastor Carlson, what do you say to people who say Richard Spencer is articulate and non-offensive and just stating a different viewpoint?
Wherever he goes, he is surrounded by people who are violent, who promote messages of hate. Those are the kind of people he incites and encourages and inspires. So I'm not going to get to hear Richard Spencer. He's going to be in a very small auditorium with 300 of his best friends. But I know who's going to be outside that auditorium and what they're going to be saying. And it's not well-spoken, and it's not polite, and it's not kind, and it's not anything that we stand for in this community.
That was Pastor Kit Carlson with the All Saints Episcopal Church in East Lansing. The church will hold a diversity festival Monday from 4 to 7 p.m. around the same time Richard Spencer is speaking at MSU.
Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world the neighborhood. And now, through our moral and ethical commitment, we must make of it a brotherhood. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools.
That is the voice of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as he spoke on the campus of Michigan State University in February of 1965. This Sunday, artwork and artifacts about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. will be on display at the East Lansing Hanna Community Center. And joining me now to talk about that is Elaine Hardy, chairperson of the Greater Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Commission.
Thank you so much, Reginald. I'm happy to be here.
Elaine, tell me about some of the objects we will see.
So what we have on exhibit are some artistic interpretations of prints that are of iconic images from the civil rights movement. So you'll see images from Selma, you'll see images from Birmingham, you'll see images from Montgomery, you'll see images from Atlanta. And what we're hoping to do is tell the story of Martin with those images in a chronological order from the time he emerged on the scene as the civil rights leader through his assassination and then up until his birthday was recognized as a national holiday.
Why is it important to share these images and Dr. King's message at this time in 2018?
One of the things that I always tell my children and anyone that I have an opportunity to is that he had a tremendous audacity in him to believe in the credo of this country, to say, listen, we are all Americans, we all are equal. And he didn't live in a time when that was the truth. He couldn't get on a bus anywhere he wanted to. He couldn't go eat anywhere he wanted to. He couldn't go to school anywhere he wanted to. And for him to have the audacity to believe that and bring a whole nation along with him and then bring a whole world along with him, his message is relevant today. We see renewed challenges to voting rights. We see a climate in this country that is not as inclusive as it could be. But one of the things about Dr. King and his message, it always embodied hope and the belief that America is the America that it says it is. And Reggie, I have to tell you that when I was born, there was no provision in the United States Constitution that protected my right to vote. And I had in my lifetime the opportunity to vote for an African-American president and a woman president. I believe in that America that Dr. King believed in. I know that tomorrow might be hard for some of us. I know that we are looking at renewed challenges, but I believe that there is a better day. And I know that because I know Americans, I know my neighbors, and I know that we will always search to be a good place to be for everyone.
Well, thank you, Elaine Hardy, chairperson of the Greater Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. History Commission, for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, what happens when the governor is asked to remove a sitting sheriff? The answer may not be as clear-cut as you think. Also, two of the leading candidates for Michigan governor make major moves in the Detroit area. And later, find out what will be different at the annual Green and White game. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Attorney General Bill Schuette's office is now reviewing calls to remove Jackson County Sheriff Stephen Rand. A federal lawsuit and audio recordings revealed Rand's use of sexist, racist, and homophobic comments. The suit also alleges Rand mocked a lieutenant in his department for a work-related hearing loss. Sheriff Rand refuses to resign.
I'm going to make an effort to make things right. And for me, that means staying in the office, doing what I set out to do.
That is Sheriff Stephen Rand of Jackson County speaking with our media partner, WLNS-TV. The Jackson City Council, Jackson County Board of Commissioners, and local NAACP branch have all asked that Rand be removed. WKAR's Corel Vega and Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta explain what's next in this case and the similarities to the calls for the ouster of another local politician a few years ago.
This case also shares some similarities with something that happened when Jennifer Granholm was governor. Tell me about that.
Back in 2008, Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was accused of financial misfeasance and abusing the powers of his office, and the Detroit City Council asked Governor Granholm to remove him. She started holding a series of public hearings on this and was working towards making a decision when the mayor, as part of a plea deal, resigned, and so that process didn't have to play out.
I'm speaking with WKAR's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta about the situation with Jackson County Sheriff Stephen Rand, who's facing an investigation from the Attorney General's office on allegations of discrimination. Rick, what do you think will come next in the case?
We know what's going to come next in the case is that the governor's office has received the request from the Jackson County Board, and it has forwarded that request to the Attorney General's office, and it wants a review of whether or not the sheriff's conduct basically meets the criteria for being removed from office.
Obviously, the situation with Kwame Kilpatrick was a little different because he did resign. But if this investigation with the Attorney General's office does play out, how long will it take to reach its conclusion?
Well, this is a very atypical situation in the first place, and in the second place, that when the Kwame Kilpatrick situation happened, the governor's office handled that internally. The determination as to whether or not Kilpatrick could and should be removed was actually handled by the governor's legal counsel, not by the attorney general at the time. And so we don't really have anything to compare it to. We do know that if the attorney general does come back with a finding that there is cause, that this meets the legal criteria for removing the sheriff, that the sheriff has to have a chance to speak. So there will probably be filings that will be a lot like legal filings. And the governor also will probably have to hold a hearing before making a determination.
I've been speaking with Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta on the situation with Jackson County Sheriff Stephen Rand, who is facing an investigation from the Attorney General's office on allegations of misconduct. Rick, thanks for speaking with me.
Always happy to.
Karel Vega, WKAR News.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Now let's turn to Michigan politics. We're nearly 8 months from electing the next governor of Michigan. Last week, we saw major moves from the Democratic and Republican parties to shore up their base. And joining me now via Skype is Chuck Stokes, public affairs and editorial director at WXYZ-TV in Detroit. Welcome to Current State, Chuck.
Reginald, it's good to be with you on this snowy day.
So first, let's start with Gretchen Whitmer. She's well known here in the Lansing area for her ties to MSU, for her work at the Capitol. But as a Democratic candidate for governor, she earned a major endorsement in Detroit.
She got the endorsement of Detroit Mayor Michael Duggan, and who's very popular here. He won re-election just a few months ago himself by about 70% of the vote. So Detroiters like him. They feel he's doing a good job. And to have that kind of endorsement is what you want when you're running for governor. She's also gotten some big endorsements before she got the endorsement of Mayor Duggan. She had Warren Evans, who's the Wayne County executive. She also has the Wayne County sheriff, Benny Napoleon. And she has some key religious leaders with her.
Are you surprised that she's just now opening the office there?
You know, I'm sure her opposition will point to the fact and say, hey, she's been out here running for a year now. Why did it take her a year to open up a campaign office in the largest city in the state? And that's a legitimate criticism if you're one of her opponents. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is from this vantage point. She's probably also thinking, I'm not going to just be the governor of the city of Detroit, even though it is the largest. I want to represent this entire state. And I don't want to look like I'm making favoritism to Detroit over any other section of this state. And I know that's a stronghold of the Democratic Party. I'll get there. But in the meantime, I have to work hard in making sure that I have some other areas of the state that maybe have not traditionally voted strongly for Democrats. And so she may be working hard in those areas, wanted to get those things done in that first year. And now she's coming around to Detroit.
We should mention her Democratic opponents. Sherene Thandahar is running a lot of political ads statewide.
Yes, she is.
And Abdul Al-Sayed is based there in Southeast Michigan. So my question is Whitmer well-known among Democrats in the Detroit area, particularly when we're talking about African-Americans?
She is not as well-known in Southeast Michigan as she is in the East Lansing area. But, you know, it doesn't take long to buy name recognition when you're in a high-profile gubernatorial race. All you have to do is get up on the air with some really powerful, well-done political ads, and you get on television and radio, and next thing you know, you become a household name. Key politicians, key leaders here, key union leaders, because she has a lot of union support, they know who she is. It's trying to just make sure that that average person who doesn't follow politics on a day-to-day basis, that they know who she is and what she represents and that they're comfortable with her.
Switch to the GOP, and Vice President Mike Pence will stump for Bill Schuette in Detroit this weekend. Has Schuette's heavy role in the MSU investigations as attorney general hurt his campaign time?
You can look at that two ways. Does it take up some of his time? Yes. But from being out on that campaign trail and stumping and shaking hands with the voters. But look at what it gets him in terms of publicity. Everybody's talking about what's happened at MSU. We've been doing it for weeks. So it gets you a lot of airtime, and it gives the impression to the people out there that you're working and you're working hard for the consumers and that you're on top of the hottest issues that affect not just this state, but affect this entire country, because MSU has become a household word in a negative way as of late, all across the country and some spots of the world.
And we know Schuette's GOP opponents include Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly and State Representative Patrick Kolbeck. Are they visible in Southeast Michigan?
Kelly in particular has been very visible. Kolbeck, he's been doing not as visible in terms of a high-profile type of campaign. I'm sure he's out there hitting the stump. Kelly comes at it from a different point of view. He's the lieutenant governor, so that alone, just incumbency in the number two position, will get you a certain amount of publicity. Every time the governor, Rick Snyder, doesn't want to go to a particular affair or he wants to help his number two guys get a little bit more name recognition and publicity, he'll have Brian Kelly go do the ribbon cutting or show up at a political dinner or make a speech at something else. And meaning the governor, has said on talk shows that I've been on and others that he thinks he has the best number two lieutenant governor in the country. And he would like to see him get to that number one position. He has not officially endorsed him, and he's not gotten out and campaigned for him yet. But you know, that's the person that he would like to succeed him because they've been together for the last 8 years.
Well, we've been talking with Chuck Stokes, public affairs and editorial director at WXYZ-TV in Detroit. Chuck, thank you for joining us via Skype.
Thank you very much.
This time last weekend, floodwaters were still draining from many parts of the capital region. A combination of melting snow, warm temperatures, and several inches of rain raised the Grand and Red Cedar Rivers to their highest levels in decades. Homes in Lansing and Okemos, as well as parts of the MSU campus, were flooded. Flood insurance is mandatory for people who live in well-established floodplains. For decades, the federal government has helped homeowners make those payments. But as WKAR's Kevin Lavery reports, that is changing.
First, it came down. Then it rose up. A flood is a costly phenomenon, and we could be in for a little sticker shock. Most homeowners don't carry flood insurance as part of their policy, but it's mandatory for people who live within established floodplains, In 1968, the National Flood Insurance Program was created to help those homeowners offset their damages. Ratepayers have been subsidized for the last 50 years. But going forward, rates will be set on an actuarial system. It's a risk management approach that translates into higher monthly premiums for policyholders.
In Lansing, we're looking at 3 or 4 times what somebody is paying today when they reach those actuarial rates, the rates where the subsidies are gone.
Rhonda Oberlin is the Hazard Mitigation Coordinator for the City of Lansing. She says too few Americans participated in the flood insurance program to keep it viable. And she says the subsidies worked counter to their original purpose.
The intention was to get everybody out of the floodplain or make people build in compliance, but actually all it's done is encourage development because flood insurance was so cheap.
It'll take some time for homeowners to reach the actuarial rate. If insurance premiums stay as they are, Oberlin says the average Lansing resident will get there in 25 years. But rates have been going up by about 6% each year, and the law allows up to 18%.
Yeah, it is a concern.
Eric Washburn owns a home in Lansing's Sycamore Park neighborhood, one of the most flood-prone in the city. He believes spiking flood insurance rates could price existing homeowners out of the neighborhood and deter would-be buyers. Every year at renewal time, Washburn requests coverage that's equal to his mortgage balance.
So whatever I've paid off on the mortgage, I can lower the flood insurance to that amount. And so that seems to take off about 10%. It may rise 10%, you know, but that kind of keeps it close.
The city wants to offer some relief. Lansing's current 2011 floodplain maps are outdated. There's fewer bridges now to constrict the water flow, which changes something called the base flood elevation. That's the level to which a river is expected to rise, and it's a key driver of flood insurance rates. Again, Rhonda Oberlin.
We actually are looking at base flood elevations on the Red Cedar that are about 3 feet too high in the city and probably into East Lansing, and then maybe 2 feet as you get closer to Williamston. Really, we haven't determined that yet, but we are looking at a remapping effort right now.
Remapping won't lower premiums for everyone. Take Lansing's low-lying Urbandale neighborhood. Oberlin says some homeowners could face flood insurance payments twice as high as their mortgage. In those cases, she says, the best solution is for the city to acquire the property and return the land to farming. Flooding is not covered under basic home insurance policies, but there are ways to supplement your coverage. Lori Connerton with the Insurance Alliance of Michigan suggests purchasing an add-on to your policy that covers sewer and water backups.
If you have water coming in through your drain in the basement, your sump pump stops working, there is coverage that you can buy in addition to your homeowner's policy that will help cover that.
Rhonda Oberlin concedes it's unrealistic to expect developers not to build in floodplains. She just wants to see it done responsibly, and she's on a mission to make every structure in Lansing flood resilient.
The rising cost of flood insurance is inevitable. It is inevitably going to affect people's property value, and we really want people to take responsibility for that and do what they can to protect themselves and their investment.
For now, the city's floodplain remapping project continues. Rhonda Oberlin hopes studies will finish this year so her team can draw new, more accurate maps. For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It's almost time to start talking Spartan football. Just ahead, we'll catch up with Coach D'Antonio and explain what may be different at this year's annual Green and White game. Also, if I told you snow was in the forecast, would you roll your eyes or jump up and down with glee? Learn how some animals at the Potter Park Zoo react to the winter weather when Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region, returns. Thank you for listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Digital News Director, and I'm joined by current sports host Al Martin. And we're already seeing the football team get ready for next season.
How about that, Reg? I mean, yeah, we saw the team open up spring practice this week, and it's such a crazy time of the year because not only do you have college football spring practice going on, Reg, but we also have both our Michigan State women's and men's basketball teams participating in the Big Ten tournament. Nothing really going on in the world of sports here in Michigan, right? It's a crazy busy time of the year, man. I'm loving it, though. I'm loving it.
Last January, Coach Mark D'Antonio appeared before reporters appearing very defensive. But Al, I understand his mood was much different last week.
On January 26th, it was prior to a Michigan State men's basketball game, and just hours after ESPN had broken a report that detailed alleged mishandlings of sexual assault cases against the program. And we saw Mark D'Antonio come in. He was very angry and adamant that he followed protocol when it came to those cases, and basically said, hey, come and get me, you know, come and get me. I have followed the correct protocol here. But he was very angry during that press conference. And you could just feel the tension in the room when he walked in and then stormed out. Right. But at practice this week, a much different tone, as you just noted, Reg. He was in a great mood, was very lighthearted with us media members. And, you know, he went into to detail about what he, you know, how excited he is about this upcoming season. I mean, this is a team that, you know, went 10-3, won a Holiday Bowl, and completely flipped the script. And this is what Coach D'Antonio had to say.
You know, only that I want to commit to be a part of the solution. You know, I made my statement on how I feel about things, but, you know, hopefully we're healing as a community and healing as a university, and it's a step-by-step process. And, you know, a lot of times spring's the time for a new beginning. So, you know, I'll use that in this case as well. You know, it's an opportunity to grow and to get better at everything that we're doing and looking at. And, you know, I think John Engler's done a great job thus far in terms of organizationally, in terms of, confronting the issue.
And again, that was MSU football coach Mark D'Antonio speaking last week. As for the players, Al, are we going to see a lot of turnover this year?
When it comes to the core of this team, Reg, I mean, Michigan State isn't losing much, if at all, really. And I'm particularly excited to you know, when it comes to the offensive side of things, I'm really excited to see just how the game of Brian Lewerke matures now. I mean, he had a stellar year last season as the quarterback for this team. We saw him grow leaps and bounds, have NFL-type throws. I'm excited for him, as well as running back L.J. Scott, who really shocked me when he made the announcement after the win against Washington State in the Holiday Bowl that he will be returning for a final season with Michigan State. So on that side of the ball, I'm excited to see just how Lewerke and Scott really mature as players.
So when is that green and white game happening?
Yes, that will take place on April 7th at 5 p.m. A bit different this year because we normally see the spring game happen usually mid-April. This year, it's bumped up. April 7th is pretty early in the calendar. And as we know, the weather in Michigan in early April is hit or miss. I wouldn't be surprised if it snowed that day, Ridge. Knock on wood. I'm not trying to throw out any bad omens there. But the thing that makes this spring game also a bit different, Reg, is the fact that it's happening at 5 p.m. This will be a night or evening spring game. So they want to test out those new permanent lights at Spartan Stadium. Should be a great atmosphere. Let's hope for good weather.
You've been listening to current sports host Al Martin, and you can hear him weekdays at 1 p.m. on AM 870 WKAR News Talk. Thanks, Al. Well, it's clear winter is not done with us, and days after that first workout by the MSU football team, the snow returned. So we're going to bring back a fun story from back in January. Some people love the cold, and some just aren't built for it, and the same goes for the animal kingdom. WKAR's Katie Cook went to the Potter Park Zoo to see which animals thrive in winter and which ones want nothing to do with it.
Potter Park is covered in a fluffy blanket of snow and is peacefully quiet.
General Curator Sarah Petchtel and I have bundled up for a quick walk around the park to visit some of the animals who are enjoying the cold.
Winter means a lot more heated water bowls, a lot more bedding, heat mats. You know, we give them heated houses, just a lot more enrichment to keep them, you know, busy and entertained if they have to spend more time than normal inside.
Personally, I binge watch TV shows to fight boredom in the winter, but the animals at Potter Park spend their time sharpening their skills.
Enrichment is ways to help animals use those natural instincts that they would be using all the time in the wild, but that they don't really have to use at the zoo necessarily, because, you know, they're kind of catered to. So we may give them objects that allow them to forage, to use their senses more fully, scent mark, all those kind of things, maybe dig. We'll see if the otters are out. Yep. So the otters, they love playing in the snow. Their water is not heated. We just use bubblers to help keep it, parts of it ice free. And they don't have any problem going in and out of that very, very cold water. So
the bald eagle calls us away from the otter exhibit. Petchtel says they do well in the cold.
Birds are really interesting because they have ways, even though they have, you know, bare feet, they have ways to not let the blood in their chilly feet cool the rest of their body. So, you know, animals have a lot of really great winter adaptations.
As we walk up to the wolf exhibit, a beautiful light gray wolf greets us at the fence.
They do pretty well in the winter. They get a nice thick coat. So sometimes you come in the spring and they look a little shaggy because all that extra winter coat's coming out.
Of course, it comes as no surprise that the snow leopard enjoys the winter. Potter Park's snow leopard is turning 21 this year. The median lifespan for a snow leopard is 15.
She was born here, so she's kind of like our, you know, our special girl for sure. And because she's so much older, we definitely make some modifications for her so she can still be comfortable in these winter months.
She's curled up inside her little house, looking very relaxed.
She's like a little old grandma, so just like, you know, your little old grandma may want some extra blankets and some extra heat. We give her a heated box. It's got a couple heat mats in it and extra straw, and she just does great.
Most African animals don't love the cold, so it does come as a surprise to hear about a rhinoceros that likes winter.
As long as there's no ice and it's sunny and the temperatures aren't cold like today, our rhinos can go out and spend a little bit of time in the sunshine. And our female rhino, Dopsy, especially loves playing in the snow.
The zoo also has camels who thrive in the winter. They're Bactrian, not like the dromedaries who live in desert temperatures.
You can always tell Bactrians have two humps like a capital letter B. Dromedaries have one hump like a capital letter D. So always a great way to tell your camels apart.
Other animals at Potter Park who enjoy the winter are the red panda, Arctic fox, and even the tigers enjoy a bit of cold. But one animal truly built for the frigid temperatures is the moose. Moose do not tolerate the heat.
The moose will lay outside in the snow and they will get, their bodies will generate so much heat that they'll stand up and they will have melted the snow all the way down to bare earth.
For this reason, the winter is a great time to come see them. And it's actually pretty special that Potter Park has them.
There's only like 8 zoos in the United States that have moose. It's pretty rare. We've had people come from very distant places actually to see them.
As far as who doesn't like winter, the lions aren't fans. And believe it or not, the penguins at the park don't do well in these winter temperatures because they're from South America, not Antarctica. But no one dislikes winter as much as the porcupine.
So many other animals increase their diet in the winter months, and he slows down. He eats less. He's super difficult to get to train. Our keepers work with him, and he's not interested. He wants to nap. He's definitely super slow, not really interested in participating.
If you yourself are more of a moose in the winter, you might want to come out to Potter Park this season for a chilly, peaceful walk. And if you're more of a porcupine, well, enjoy your winter naps, and we'll see you in the spring. For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
Thanks for listening to Current State from WKAR. And once again this year, WKAR is bringing you pop-up story events, a chance for you to tell your story to a small audience. Today, we bring you the story of a mid-Michigan mother who talked about a transformation in her life.
My name is Camille, and it just so happens that at a young age, I had a daughter, and her name is Camille as well. I had her at a pretty young age, and she was an awesome kid. But when she got into high school, she started getting into different type of things. And I started realizing that she was doing some of the same things that I had done in high school, like drugs and boys. And I probably should stop right there with that. But she started really developing some really bad behavior. And I was really trying to convince her to stay in school, because she was skipping school. She had just really got out of control. And I was really trying to convince her. I was really trying to talk to her. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever had daughters, but when you give birth to a daughter, you've given birth to a genius. And all Earth's problems are now solved because she's here. Everybody else just step back. She knows everything. She'll take care of this. And that's exactly what I had. And I was really on her. And one day I just came to her and I was gonna be stern. I was lecturing her, you need to stay in school, you need to do this. And she looked me right in my face and said, well, if staying in school and going to college is so great, why didn't you do it? Now, me, I'm very competitive. I don't believe in losing, especially an argument to my own kid. So one thing I noticed about my life was that I watched my mother be on welfare, and I watched her mother be on welfare. And at that time, I was also on welfare. And so, because I'm not gonna lose an argument, I called up a university and I set myself up an appointment for when she would be out of school so that she can come with me. And so I got admitted to a university, and it was time for me to go see an advisor, and I had to schedule classes. And I said, I made my appointment for when she was out of school, so that she could go with me. And so we went and we did all of that. And just to make a long story short, is that eventually it worked. It actually worked. She actually ended up graduating high school. And she actually ended up going to college. And at the time, I'm still in college trying to prove a point. And I was studying technology project management. And, you know, I'm so excited, you know, this worked. And I asked her, I said, well, what do you want to be? And she says, oh, I'm going to be a neurological surgeon. That's exactly what my bank account said. I like to call that story the day my bank account said I cracked jokes. But how do you tell your kid that they can't finish school simply because you can't afford it? And after all, it was the entire purpose of me going. So I didn't really know what to do. And so you guys' tax dollars kicked in, and she went to the United States Army. I kept pushing and pushing, and she called me one day. She went down with her friend on a buddy system. Her friend really wanted to go. She just took the test with her friend, and she said she scored high enough to be able to study medicine with him. And it was just like, thank you, God. Oh, my God, thank you. And so then she went into the United States Army. And so the interesting thing about this being about transformation is that I was so close to graduating, it wouldn't have made any sense for me to stop. I only had one semester left. And so I went ahead and I finished my semester. And I ended up being the only kid between my mother and my father to graduate with a four-year degree. Well, before that, as an African-American woman, my whole life was set up around statistics. I was supposed to be on social services. I was supposed to, if I had a kid, I would collect child support. Everything was just set just like this for me. This is how it is. And I had no other hopes. I had no other expectations. But when they put that degree in my hand, everything just started to change. Everything started to change. And what was at one point for me just a one-way street, when I was standing there holding that degree, I realized that it was a whole highway at that point. I realized that I had options after options. I started looking at jobs and deciding I would never want to work there. When before that, it was just like, oh God, please, somebody hire me. But now it was just like, now it kind of almost transformed me into knowing my worth. And so now I'm studying information security in the master's program, all because I lectured a kid, and a lecture I thought that was to change somebody else's life, changed the life of my entire household. So the day I gave her that lecture was the day that I transformed into the person that's standing here today.
And that will end this week's Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Remember, we're always looking for feedback from you on the WKAR News Facebook page. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick, and for the entire WKAR News team, we'll connect with you next weekend.